and welcome to the French Connections Wednesday edition. Today's date is the 30th day of August, 2006. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here with me for this broadcast. Of course, we're always working to try to add a little color to the gray areas of this fight we've all been fighting, and today's not going to be an exception to that rule. We've got Christopher Bolin on talking about Odigo. Now, many of you out there probably have heard the name Odigo. You've also have an idea that it's probably connected with something the Israelis had done. Many of you are not aware, however, just who ran that organization and what it was they had done prior to 9/11 and during the and just subsequent to it, and the people that were actually involved in it, and where in America they were set up and doing business, and what their history was. The person we're going to talk about today is a gentleman, I won't call him that because that's the wrong word, a criminal named Kobi Alexander, or Jacob Alexander. And he's an Israeli military officer connected to Odigo. And this goes back to Converse Technologies. And the fact is, all of this stuff is extremely important because it not only does it tell the full facts about 9/11 and the prior warnings that everyone thinks is an urban myth. In fact, I think a couple of programs have even claimed it to be an urban myth, that Israelis were warned in advance of this attack and that they should not be going anywhere near that area to stay safe. And so I'm going to bring Christopher right up. Christopher, are you with me?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you quite well, Chris. You know, this is one of the things that has been been bantered around in the truth movement. I hate using that term because it's often the deception movement, but the truth movement. And what we've got here, it's pretty clear to me that these people were forewarned. What information have you dug up on this one?
Yes, the Odigo Converse Technology scam has returned to the front pages, at least of the business section, since Kobi Alexander fled the country about 3 weeks ago with hundreds of millions of dollars of ill-gotten money. Kobi, otherwise Jacob Alexander, is an Israeli, as you said, of military background, who was the CEO of the Israel-based Converse Technology, which, by the way, makes a product called the Audio Disc, which is sold to many intelligence and law enforcement agencies in the United States, which is basically a black box that does surveillance of their communications. It's a product that's made in Herzliya, Israel, where most of the employees of Converse Technology
and let's clear up exactly why Herzliya is significant,
sure.
Christopher.
Sure, Herzliya is a well-to-do suburb to the north of Tel Aviv, which is the headquarters of Israeli military intelligence, the Mossad, and it's also the place where they have a university called the Interdisciplinary Center, where they teach their Mossad and Mossad-related people the tricks of the trade.
Well, and there are some instrumental people that were involved in the formation of that or the expansion of that school, that university for spies. One of them, I think, is Ronald Lauder, and what we know is he was involved also with the negotiations for the transfer of ownership of the World Trade Center and of Stewart Air Force Base. Am I correct?
Very important, yeah. Ronald Lauder, the son of the Estee Lauder cosmetics company, he was the person who basically was the driving force behind the privatization of the World Trade Center and, as you said, also Stewart Air Force Base.
Mm.
He was the director of Governor Pataki's privatization board, and it was he, Ronald Lauder, who was the impetus behind the privatization of the World Trade Center, along with Louis Eisenberg and other people. And it's interesting to note here that Ronald Lauder's hired Pataki's wife, Libby Pataki, I think her name is, she has been a long-term employee of Ronald Lauder as a paid consultant to the tune of something like $100,000 a year.
Ah, and nobody knows what she's consulting on, but I'm sure the governor loves to have that paycheck. Here's the interesting thing, Christopher. I mean, that doesn't mean anything on the face of it, but let's take a look at what one of the filials or the branches of Converse did, this company called Odigo. Can you explain to us what Odigo is and what we're going to claim that they were involved in?
Yeah, it's very important. Odigo is one of those instant messaging companies that is able. The Israelis when these kinds of instant messaging things were coming up on the market, Israel, an Israeli company, came out with one called ICQ. And what that would do is that would scan the internet and looking for example, if you're looking to see if somebody's online, if you're looking to see if Eric is online, for example, you could put out this ICQ tool and they would find Eric and you would get a message through to him. Odigo improved on that and they have this text instant messaging service that computer users could use, and it has it also has buddy lists, but it has something faculty called People Finder. So you could send out a message and say, I want to send this message to a certain demographic. For example, I want to send this message to all Israelis who use Odigo. Or I want to send this message to all people who speak Hebrew, for example. And then your message in Hebrew, for example, would go out to all of the users who happen to be online or have their cell phone handy who use Odigo. Mm-hmm. And it's important to understand that this claim about the 4,000 Israelis who didn't show up at work that day at the World Trade Center, this originated with the Jerusalem Post and the Israeli Foreign Ministry. The Jerusalem Post reported that the Foreign Ministry of Israel or whatever, one of the ministries, had received calls about 4,000 Israelis who should have been or were expected to have been at work at the World Trade Center on September 11th. And this story did not have its genesis among any Arab media. This started with the Jerusalem Post in Jerusalem.
Yeah. Now they didn't. By and large, the people that got this message, of course, heeded the warning and didn't go to work. Does anybody have a fair accounting on how many Israelis or even how many Jews were lost their lives in 9/11?
Well, I think that all told, I think that something like 3 Israelis are said to have died in I think 2 on the airplanes and 1 on the ground. So whether or not the 3 on the airplane, the 2 on the airplane actually did die, they were very highly placed people also with Israeli intelligence. I think one was a former Shin Bet officer, what have you. But something like 3 out of 4,000. So they fared very well.
Okay. Well, the rest of us didn't, huh?
Right.
So here's the interesting thing. The company was, when was the founding of this company? Do you have the date of its beginnings?
Yeah, Odigo was created, I think, in the 1990s. Now, it's important to say when it was created and et cetera. You have to understand that these technologies that we're talking about, whether we're talking about a software or an instant messaging facility that is sold under the Odigo or Comverse technology, this is basically Mossad technology. This is a computer technology that has been created and written and produced in Israel. Usually it's not a fresh product. It's like a innovation on a current theme, but they tweak it in such a way that it's useful for them. This is pretty typical Israeli behavior, to tweak some technology to give them an advantage in a game which is very unscrupulous. Now, in the case of Odigo, it was started by a guy named Avner Ronin. And his girlfriend, Mataika, she has a strange name. She's a little older than he, and she was actually his computer programming instructor in the Israeli military. Both Avner and his wife came to the United States in the 90s, set up shop in Manhattan, and started a company. It's interesting that the New York Times magazine did an article about them. And they write about these people who came to the United States with an IPO, initial public offering, in mind. But if you read the article and if you read what these people did, this young couple from Israel, they were clearly on a mission, and their mission wasn't even one of business. If it had been really business, they would have been associating with other people in the business. No, they kept to themselves, had a very quiet life, started this company, and began marketing and promoting Odigo in the U.S. market. But it's important to understand here, with these companies like Odigo, Comverse Technology, and all these other ones that they're affiliated with, these Israeli companies maintain the lion's share of the company, the employees and everything, research and development, is all done in Israel, manufacturing, everything. The only purpose of establishing an office in the United States is to infiltrate and to get into the U.S. market and to get the product onto U.S. networks and computers.
Well, now, we have these folks situated in the New York region or in the Massachusetts region. I'm not sure if they were around 128, weren't they?
They were in New York.
New York.
Avner Ronin and his wife or girlfriend Ronin, they were in New York City. They started out in the Manhattan, and that's where the Odigo was based. Odigo had an office, I think a block or two blocks from the World Trade Center. Now the U.S. headquarters.
Now, you talk about in the article about a parent company called Efrat Future Technologies.
Yes, Efrat Future Technologies. Yes.
Now, what relationship did that have to Jacob Alexander? And since these guys were military men, what in the heck is a military guy leaving their high level post in Israel, coming over to America to set up companies that are infiltrating computer networks? That sounds like a spy job to me, and of course it does to you too.
This Kobe Alexander founded Efrat Future Technology with another Israeli engineer, and he then was introduced to a new product that he thought would be really wonderful. So they went back to Israel, supposedly, and created Efrat Future Technologies, someplace in Tel Aviv. And that became the parent company of Comverse Technology. And the Comverse Technology was the parent company, supposed parent company, which is actually just kind of like the marketing end of the company in the United States. But they create the American company so that they can take advantage of U.S. Tax laws and things like that.
Ah. Now, we discussed privately about some of the placement of these groups and some of the people. Are there areas in the United States where you find more activity from these people than others?
Oh, absolutely. This company was in I think it's Dutchess County or Suffolk County. I don't know. It's one of the counties on Manhattan on the Long Island, which is close to.
Well, we have Nassau County and Suffolk.
Nassau. I think it's Nassau County.
Yeah.
But it's an area called. There's an area in this case, an area called Great Neck,
right.
Which is described by many people who live there as being a very very a Jewish ghetto. Actually, they call.
Well,
it
it's a wealthy
ghetto.
Jewish ghetto, if it's a ghetto at all. I mean, the word ghetto brings to mind poverty. If you take a look at Great Neck, it is one of the wealthiest communities in the United States.
Right, and it's in this area that. This Comverse Technology and Jacob Alexander were based. Although he maintained, if you see, he maintained numerous number of addresses in that area. That's where the company was based.
Have we ever found any connections to him and Jack Abramoff or any of the other Do we get back to Abe Foxman with these people, or are there any connections to Cheney we can find, or who do these people do business with in America that we've been able to see?
That's a good question, but I think that when we're talking about these people, these military men from the Mossad and these computer people, they tend to stick to themselves. I mean, this is like the Amit Yoran people who have infiltrated the most sensitive computer networks in the United States. Amit Yoran was the former czar of cybersecurity. He was appointed by George Bush. He held an appointed position and things like that under, I think it was, Department of Homeland Security. But, you know, these Israelis, if you read, you know, the reports about them, like one in the New York Times, they stick to themselves. It's interesting that I found the, in the archive, I looked at this magazine in the microfiche form, microfilm form.
Yeah.
And the photograph of the two founders of Mr. Ronin and Mr. and Mrs. Ronin, it's photographed in such a strange way. It's photographed in their apartment, and they're photographed sitting at the table in the dark so that you cannot even see their faces. You only see like a silhouette of these people. I think that's really amazing. And the thing is about what Kobe Alexander was heavily invested. He was a part owner of Odigo going back to at least like early 2000.
Now, after the World Trade Center went down, what was the activity that you've been able to follow on these groups? Was there further insider trading from this group? I mean, how did he come to use his position to bilk people and investors and whatnot, and then leave the country? What's the story on that?
Right. Well, what Kobe Alexander was doing with a handful of other Israelis was that he was what they were doing is they were doing with their stock options. They had a lot of stock options. What they were doing was that they were going back to their stock options and changing the dates that they received the option in order to maximize the profit that they could get when they sold their stock. So mm-hmm. that's what they were doing, and it's they did it for years and years and years. It's interesting that going back into the 90s, almost 5-6 years before 9/11, if I recall, he was getting paid. He was one of the highest paid executives in the United States, Kobe Alexander. He made well over $100 million a year, but most of his money, like 9/10 of it, was made through these fraudulent stock options. And, you know, I wrote about this. I wrote about this insider trading and stuff at Converse Technology back in April of 2005. Yeah. So it was in the public domain. People knew about it. In March of this year, the Wall Street Journal finally wrote about it. And also the leading newspaper in Israel that deals with business matters is called Globes. And yet this nothing was done until, and he didn't do anything to change his ways, until the Securities and Exchange Commission put out a civil complaint for him, and until the Eastern District of the City of New York, or New York, put out a criminal complaint for
him. Is that Spitzer's office?
That's not Spitzer. It's not Spitzer who's in charge of that office. It's somebody named Mrs. Mauser or Mouse something. I don't remember her name. That's not Spitzer, I don't think. But it's Brooklyn in Long Island. It's out there. That's the Eastern District. And since their company is based in like we said, in Great Neck on Long Island, that's the jurisdiction it falls under. But this came into the news then about a week or 2 weeks ago in the business sections of the Wall Street or the New York Times, for example, and they revealed that this man, as late as the last days of July of this year, was able to wire $57 million to his account in Israel and get out of the country, to flee the country without anybody knowing the better. I know there's some little reports in the news now that he's been seen in Sri Lanka or this or that. I think there's really no question about it. He's in Israel and has been so.
Well, it wouldn't matter because maybe you can explain to the listeners that there is no extradition treaty with America and Israel, is there?
No. The thing is that it's voluntary. Israel will only turn somebody over if they want to. And it's interesting that they said that given his military status, it's very unlikely that he would be sent back to the United States. He's 54 years old. That means he has 1 year left in the Israeli military. But I thought it's odd that the military status of this 54-year-old man should prevent them from sending him back to the United States. He, in my opinion, like the other Israelis involved in these companies, are here on a mission. They're on a hostile mission, and their mission is to sell or to get their surveillance software or their Trojan horses and backdoors and all these things to get these things onto the most sensitive American networks. I mean, I've written about this a great deal. I don't see that it's ever been resonated anywhere.
Well, we've talked about it before. This is not our first conversation about this either, Chris.
Not in the print media. I mean, for example, Unisys, it's headed by a guy named Larry Weinbach. Unisys provides the software for the entire U.S. government, all across the board.
Yep.
And this Larry Weinbach fella, who's the current CEO of Unisys, he integrated several Israeli software packets that we know of, Checkpoint Software and some others. He integrated their software into the Unisys software so that the end user, the person who eventually gets this product on his computer, has no way of knowing it contains Israeli code.
And here's the interesting thing. Hasn't Google just moved over there and opened up a huge research facility?
Oh, that's very likely.
Well, they did. I mean, I read an article in the New York Times saying that their expansion plans took them to Israel because of the quote-unquote strong environment of technology and computer computer capacity or whatever. In other words, they said that there was a very large number of workers there with high skills that they could employ at Google. So they're building this huge Google facility over there, which should bring everybody nightmares.
but the founders of Google, I think, are two Russian Jews, and in the case of other companies like Oracle, headed by Mr. Ellison,
Ellison,
in many of these software companies in the United States, They are very pro-Israel to start with. They give money to Israel, support to Israel, and they work with Israel. And I, you know, for me, this would be an obvious national security threat that you would not any government, self-respecting government, would not buy product from another nation to put on their national computers. It's interesting that France is one country that has resisted this the most.
Well,
Denmark, I think it was.
Well, yes, and the French are actually writing their own code over here. I know that. But here's the interesting thing also. I mean, as an example, not necessarily, related to this particular story, but there's a young man. He was a fire control technician in the U.S. Navy, an E-5, which is, you know, rather well healed within the structure in the Navy. And he's got the most sensitive firing code technology on submarine-based missiles that he was shipping over to Israel. They caught him. Now, here's where that's not strange, because we've had, I think, 57 different examples of Israelis being caught spying on Americans. What is bizarre is that he was put in the brig, and no one was told about it for 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't reported to anybody. Apparently, they were trying to figure out what to do with this case, because normally they just ship these guys back to Israel when they're caught. But this one here finally slipped out, and I think somebody's in trouble for letting it slip out that they actually had caught this guy. And, you know, Christopher, I look at this stuff, and I can't believe it. You know, I believe it now. But if you had asked me this a year and a half, 2 years ago, I'd have said, "Say it isn't so." I wouldn't have been able to wrap my brain around it.
Right.
But now, being in this and knowing what I know now, it is so. And what is it we're going to do about this? This is just an astonishing story you're telling here.
Well, one of the things about the Odigo that it's a story that I found actually was excised, was censored from the archives. It did appear in the Washington Post, at least in a short article. I thought I read it also in the New York Times, but I do not find that anywhere in the archives of newspapers. But it was reported, you know, on the 15th of September 2001, shortly, a day or two after, that employees, Israeli-based employees of Herzliya, had received this message warning of an imminent attack at the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And this was hours before it happened. And one of the presidents, the vice president of the company, I think it's Alex Diamandis, told the press that this warning was accurate to the minute. And that's important. And then when they wrote about this, in the papers, they said that the FBI had sent a high-ranking person over there to Israel. They had interviewed Alex Diamandis, who is apparently the Israeli-based vice president, and then the story was dropped. The contents of the message were never revealed. The recipients of the message were never revealed. The senders of the message were never revealed. But it's interesting, he said that several employees had reported this. And he said there may have been more recipients, but they haven't come forward.
Well, let me ask you this, Christopher. I think this is probably a germane question at this point. How high up would their control have to be in the U.S. government to quash a story like this? I mean, let's face it, that wouldn't be mid-level. This is something that has to go all the way up to the top, doesn't it?
Well, the quashing of the investigation was done by Michael Sheratov. There's no question about that. Michael Sheratov was the Assistant Attorney General at 9/11 since July 2001, and remained so for several years after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
He was the Assistant Attorney General under John Ashcroft, supposedly under John Ashcroft, who actually provided, who wrote the Patriot Act, who provided the names of the 19, the names and photographs of the 19 so-called hijackers, and who oversaw the criminal investigation by the FBI of 9/11. Now, if you've been following 9/11 as closely as I think you have, you know that the FBI is the instrument of concealment. The FBI is in this case involved in a criminal cover 911.
Well, and it seems to me they have a far more important role being played in this than the CIA or the NSA. And I think a lot of the rank and file workers down in Langley have actually balked at what they've been seeing, and many of them have been weeded out by Porter Goss and others, because they're not on board with some of this. And what we're seeing out in the real world is a lot of these CIA types are dropping a lot of hints out in the real world as to what is really going on.
Yes. Well, I would hope so. I know that there's, but the FBI, of course, was the agency who secreted evidence, who confiscated and secreted evidence, such as these pieces that were picked up by Sam Danner at the Pentagon, such as the videotapes that oversaw the Pentagon, such as all of the evidence that came from any plane that landed in New York City or struck New York City, et cetera, et cetera.
And they go all the way back, don't they, to Oklahoma City? They were all over that. They were all over the first World Trade Center.
And the Wellstone murder.
That's right.
But you bring up the 1993 attack at the World Trade Center, which I think was only meant as a publicity stunt in order to prime the pump of the public's mind to conceive the idea that these twin towers are being targeted by militant Arab and Islamic groups. That's what the purpose of that first one was. And it's interesting that at that time, Michael Chertoff was, I think, the Attorney General for the
Northern District.
District Attorney in that part of Newark, where he's from, where he was born at least, mm-hmm. and that he oversaw the management of this case against Mohammed Salem and these people. And you know, in this case, it was reported in the New York Times that the FBI informant, the Egyptian named Salem, was paid $1 million. To inform on this group that supposedly did the 1993 attack at the World Trade Center.
Well, you know,
for Egyptian $1 million, you can do a lot with that.
Boy, oh boy, can't you ever? And you know, here's the interesting thing: as you and I both talk about this, one needs to wonder just how many people in the FBI organization, and well, for that matter, the people in the computer fields that know this kind of technology is being loaded into the systems. How much acquiescence do these people have? It seems to me that there has to be more knowledge out there about this than we've been reading. And when are people going to come forward on this?
Well, that's a good question. That's the thing that has not happened. You know, people have not come forward with what they know. Sam Danner, who I think is telling the truth, he never told me that he wasn't telling the truth. But people like Sam Danner need to be supported. And when people do come forward, whether they're eyewitnesses or whether they're aware of some of this going on, they need to come forward. But when they do, in this day and age, they're slammed. They're attacked, and they find that there is no support. They find that there is no NBC and CNN don't come knocking on their door, and they find themselves, attacked, like I was at my house, you know. I've been writing about this for years, and I've been anticipating an attack by agents of the government for years.
Well, let me tell the listeners something, Christopher, that I know about you, okay? When you were over at your brother's house, at your family home, over a year and a half ago when we were talking, you told me that they were surveilling your house back then, and that you had a neighbor that was hovering around you, trying to insert themselves into your life and asking very bizarre and personal questions about the things you were doing, and you were suspicious of the surveillance way back when. And so, there to me, I mean, I knew that there was already stuff happening, that they were putting people in your way long before this even happened. So I wasn't surprised when I heard this. And
yeah,
so
the surveillance is almost meant to be, in my case, I think it was meant to be apparent. I think it was meant to kind of scare me off.
Mm.
And it did. When we finally realized that these two people who had befriended us, when we finally discovered last summer about this time that they were actually informing the FBI, and they were informing the FBI, when we found that out, we made plans to go to Europe because we felt very vulnerable at our house.
And with good reason.
Yes. We only came back in March of this year, and then I spent as much time as possible elsewhere in this country, because I knew that when I would go back to that house, I would be again, eavesdropped and surveilled, and then something might happen. And son of gun, I was only there 2 weeks, and I was attacked.
Well, you know, fortunately, Halia was able to get the word out quickly, and I was on the line when she got in touch with Eric, and I'll tell you something. I went worldwide with it. I went everywhere. I'll tell you, I knocked on every door and said, "You got to put this up." And boy, I'll bet you dollars to donuts. They were surprised by the heat that came down. It was wonderful to see.
Yeah, you were very effective. You were very effective. I was at a police open house the other day to basically look at their taser guns and see what they do there at that police department. And they had a public open house, so I took the advantage. I wanted to show my kids this place where it all happened, and so that they could maybe get over the trauma a little bit better, because my little daughter saw the whole thing and she was very traumatized by it. So I went there and I spoke to this Richard Russo, who is a spokesperson for the agency. He came down actually when they found out that I was there, and with my arm in a sling, asking questions about tasers and whatnot. And when he came down, he told me at the end, you know, he was a very friendly guy. He said, you know, I had no idea who you were before this. Well, he doesn't read the papers very much, because I ran for mayor in this town in 2001. But he said, you're quite a writer, he said. And he said that he had no idea that there was even a conspiracy about 9/11 lurking. He didn't even know that. But he said that when this arrest happened, they were getting calls from France, Argentina, and places in Canada. And he said they were really amazed at the outpouring. And I have to thank you for your quick action.
Well, you know, it was probably repeated calls from France that he was talking about, because I talked to this guy as well. And I actually got in touch with people I know over in Australia as well. So I got people from around the globe involved. But you know what? This is the kind of response.
That's important. We have the internet. We have email. We have the telephones at our disposal. This is effective citizen action.
Yeah.
And you know, if things like this, if people acted like this more often, we could do a lot to stop this kind of abuse and these things. You know, that's what it takes. The American citizens have to wake up and realize that they have to take action, even if the action is only sending an email or making a telephone call. But you cannot just sit back and consume the news and expect the world to get better.
You have
to do something.
That's right, Christopher. And you know, here's the thing, too. I mean, people like you and I on the front lines here, we rely on the help of our listeners and the people that are interested in changing things for the better. And their participation, I want to say right now, thank you very much for all of you out there who did help. But we outnumber these people. We've got more power than them. We've got a lot more capacity to take all these things back from them. It's just a matter of congealing around the same goals here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, you know, putting out the facts like this, I had a guy on last night, a real wonderful researcher named James Dickey, two nights ago. The man he's been 30 years in the research side of this stuff, and his interview, for me, it just told me that we can't afford another 30 years of what he's watched. We have to stop it now.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. I think that 9/11 was the ultimate wake-up call. And clearly, you know, the great majority, 99.9% of the American population and the world population, want to catch the people who did September 11th and who are committing these terror acts in places like Iraq and what have you. I mean, it's very clear to, I think, anybody that these attacks inside of, for example, the Iraqi markets, where normal, everyday Iraqis are being blown to bits every day. This is not sectarian violence. This is violence being imposed on the Iraqi people from outside, and it is being done by the occupying powers for the agenda of the occupying powers. And you know, the Anglo-American invasion of Iraq has brought nothing but chaos, death, and destruction to the region.
Yeah.
And that should, you know, this has to stop.
Well, you know, you've left, I understand you've left RBN. I'm going to give you the opportunity anytime you'd like to talk. Our listenership has doubled. And the fact is, we're becoming a more important force in telling these facts, Christopher, because there are very few places you can't hear, you will hear anything but, you know, it's Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld. And I know darn well it's not Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld at the top of this pyramid. And the fact is, you know, we can get the people behind us with the right kind of work and the right kind of effort. And I see it happening. However, there's a lot of people trying to get in our way and muddy our waters, aren't there?
Oh yeah, that's absolutely for sure. You know, it's interesting that when I was attacked by these thugs in my front yard, they were heavily armed, armor-clad thugs. You know, it went out that a 9/11 researcher was attacked, and I mean, I'm not the first; I'm like the third. In this case, I'm not dead like Mike Zabur and the other guy.
Yeah.
But I was attacked in my house. It's clearly a very anomalous and bizarre at the police attack. There's no, but the thing was is that what's happened in the aftermath is that people who are supposedly associated with the 9/11 truth movement, people like Victor Thorne or Scott Roof
mm-hmm.
is his real name, and Lisa Giuliani, and now I see Carl Schwartz, they have attacked me without ever contacting me. They're attacking me now, you know, adding sort of insult to injury. But I have to ask myself, well, wait, if these supposed 911 researchers are attacking me after I've been attacked by the police, I have to wonder what their agenda is.
Well, you know, we've known for a long time what their agenda is, and, you know, I've tried to stay above the fray and put out the good research because basically, if you take a look at the work we've done over the years here, it's going on years with Eric and myself and you've been a big part of our work too. It's going to come down to the facts. It's going to come down to our efforts. And look, I asked somebody a simple question just yesterday. I said, if we were working for bad guys, who would our bad guy team be? I mean, who would we be working for? The only people that are benefiting from our work are the people.
Well, I want to say one thing. I've been on your show, and I've met you at your house in France.
Yep.
But I haven't been on your show in a long time. I don't know. It's been close to a year. And you.
No,
and Eric
that's not true. You were on about 5 months ago.
Okay. But you and Eric have done remarkable work in ferreting out the ages of disinformation in the 9/11 truth movement. Now that's something that I just don't have the time to do. I haven't had the time to do that. I have to write my articles, and I've been approaching 9/11 from the other side, from the evidence trail. But you two have done a lot of work on that, and now I see that it's very important because now some of the people that you have pointed out as being disingenuous 9/11 truth seekers are attacking me very vociferously.
Yeah.
You know, for example, Wing TV. Why did Wing TV come out with this report about me in which they only advocated the police position and never even contacted me in a case that appears to be, obviously, a case of police abuse?
Well, you know, they and here's the saddest part about it, is they're trying to steal our research as their and make it their own because once we put it out, it's out in the public realm, and they want to be in charge of the information that's put out.
Right.
So they end up inviting guests that we've had on already, and Jim Condit was one of them, and there's been others. And the fact is that, you know, this is a typical move of people that spread disinformation. They want to be in charge of the message, and this is the same thing we've received, you know, from several quarters, including over at GCN. I mean,
mm-hmm.
but you know, enough said about that. I really think that we've really
right.
beaten that dead horse. Here's the thing: there is more information coming out every day about how we can fight back, and we've talked about fighting back, and you know, part of this battle is going to be solutions that are going to be workable. And the biggest challenge I face right now, Christopher, and maybe you can lend some of your inspiration or even some experience to it. What kinds of things do you see we can do other than just, you know, try to get bigger audiences? I mean, that seems to be a good idea, but it's not enough.
No. It's clearly not enough. And the thing is that we have to, like I said before, we have to take action.
Yeah.
We have to take action. And when I mean action, I don't mean that we have to go and get our guns and try to confront the growing police state.
No, no.
Then you'll wind up being dead.
That's right.
You know, rather than just having a fractured elbow and a taser stuck in your back like I was. What we have to do is we have to do the things that citizens of this country can do. I mean, like, for example, file freedom of information requests with authorities, demand the evidence be presented, take action, make phone calls to these congressmen and these people, demand that the FBI reveal this evidence. For example, you know, I contacted the FBI about the evidence that Sam Danner said he was picking up on the Pentagon lawn. It's in hefty bags, and they say in a storehouse someplace. Well, I think it's high time that evidence be made part of the public record, just as all of the other evidence that the FBI confiscated. It's been now 5 years, and I think that the people in a free nation have the right to see the evidence of 9/11. And this has to be demanded. This has to be protested, as the French would do.
Well, they would. They pour out into the streets over here, that's for sure. Well, you know, Chris, I want to thank you for taking the time. I know you had a lot of other things going on this evening, and I did wait because this was important enough for me to have this information about Converse and Odigo out there. Any more research that you're able to put together, please feel free to just contact myself, Eric, or anyone else that has contact with us. We'll put the information out there. And here's the other thing. We need to start looking into a nonprofit fund for your legal defense for this. And I know that the best thing to do would be to start a nonprofit corporation and then place the monies in a trust of some sort, because that keeps you free of having any tax liabilities and the rest of it. I'm wondering if you have done anything in that regard, or would you like to, and is there something one of our listeners could put together so that donations could come and flow into your legal fund and for that matter, taking care of some of the medical expenses?
Yeah, that would be very good. I would really think that'd be a good thing to do, and maybe Eric Hushman knows some way of doing that with his website. I really also realize I have to start a website, because for years I've just been writing for American Free Press and posting here and there, but that's not the only way to reach the people. I reach a too small of an audience, and you know it's true. I'm going to need some help because you see I think that this case probably should be fought. I'm a journalist. It happened to me in my home in the United States of America. And it happens to, you know, this kind of abuse happens to people all across the world and across the United States on a daily basis. But I'm a journalist, and if I don't fight this, and if I don't stand up and fight the good fight, who will?
That's right. Well, you got a home here if you want to make one, so just know that going out, and you can give it some thought and talk to Hallie and the rest. But the French Connection's getting bigger every day. We're getting more and more traction in the world, and you know I'm not just fighting American fight over here. Eric and I, we just were on British TV in front of an audience of 4 million. I was in South Africa doing a show with an audience of 20 million. The simple fact of the matter is that this is not a stoppable force that they're building here. And, you know, it's about getting the facts out, Chris. And I'm not going to stop until they're all out there on the table for people to see.
Well, you know, the Zionist criminal network has to be stopped. You just ask the people of Lebanon. The most beautiful, prosperous nation in the Middle East has been devastated by a criminal act, criminal aggression by the State of Israel. And Ehud Olmert, I wrote about Ehud Olmert back in early June.
Yeah.
He has a criminal background, and he is connected to 9/11 through his fellow who ran security at Boston's Logan Airport that day. I mean, how obvious does this have to be? And but you know, even Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the United Nations, does not get any traction with the Israelis. He told the Israelis to stop their naval and air blockade of Lebanon, and the Israelis told him to go take a hike. I mean, you know, it's going to take popular public action to force the Israelis to abide by the law. They have no intention of abiding by any law,
yeah.
And it's time for the people of the world to demand it.
Well, I think they're waking up. So I want to let you get back to your family and get yourself rested over there. And I want you to give my best to your family, Christopher. And
thank you very much.
Thank you for being on the French Connection. You're always welcome here, my friend.
Thank you.
Thanks again. Ladies and gentlemen, Christopher Bolin, we discussed, of course, the Converse technology and Odigo issue here. We've actually spoken on air about this in the past, but this is another chapter in that sickening saga. And also a little bit about Christopher on the mend here. And he's back writing full-time and, you know, could use your support. So keep your minds open to possibly helping Chris out in some way, because he's going to have legal bills. He does need some you know, legal help to make sure that this case is heard properly. And, of course, journalists are not highly paid people. Trust me, ladies and gentlemen. So, you know, you've opened your pockets for Eric and I to keep this radio show going. I hope you can maybe consider doing that for Christopher. But until the next broadcast, and that will be soon, ladies and gentlemen, this is Daryl Bradford Smith saying be well. Bye-bye now.